Welcome back to Brass Tacks. Thank you, Press, with you along with John Stout. We go straight to our phone lines. You are on the air. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Price.
How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. Go ahead with
your
question.
Guest.
Yes, go right ahead with your question.
Yes. Okay. This is from Dr. Kev and Dr. Ford, and then you have one for Dr. Beth. He said he wants to keep the COVID out of the hospital. So I want to know, how do you handle a stabbing and shooting coming to the hospital if you don't know if they have COVID? Right? That's my first question. My other question is to Dr. Beth. Do you follow up on a person that recovered from COVID and person that went on ventilators, how many survived? And the other one is the person that tested positive for COVID and no contact or no travel history. What is the update on that? And Mr. Nurse Waterman, do you agree that Dr. Warwick should be given one of the rooms to operate? Hello?
Yes, you're giving your questions. You're giving about four questions so far. So let's deal with the first one first. How do you handle a stabbing? The question was, how do you handle
a stabbing and shooting coming into the hospital? He said he don't want no COVID in the hospital. So how will he know that the person that get shoot or stabbed don't have the COVID?
Okay, Dr. Cave?
Yes, well, you make a point where anything is possible, but what is likely or probable at this stage of the pandemic in Barbados right now is that it will be unlikely. If there is any suggestion as to how the person was before this emergency accident, whatever occurred, then we can swab them. But bear in mind, a swab will take several hours to get back and treatment cannot be delayed, which is why the accident and emergency department has had to be reconfigured, and it's the one place in hospital where we take precautions and treat as if. So if it later turns out that the person after testing was positive, we would have already started the treatment as if. Now, nothing in life is 100%, and the same with this disease. There is no way we can tell every single person, because even if we tested every single person, there is still the stage at which they're at may not show up on the test. So unfortunately, this is part of the reality that we now have to live with COVID, which is why it's so important in every case to maintain the social distancing and hand washing and respiratory hygiene. But specifically to accidents, there's a protocol of trying to establish if there were risk factors from before, but in an emergency, they are treated as if, and their treatment will not be withheld waiting for them to be tested or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Your second question?
The second one is for Dr. Beth. Person that went on ventilators, how many survived, Dr. Beth?
So I would actually have to deflect that to Dr. Ford, who's managing the patients in the isolation facilities.
Hi, thanks for your question. There were three ventilated patients. The others were on ventilators, but by a different method, so they weren't what we call intubators, put the tube down the mouth into the lung. Those three ventilated patients had died. The others who were on the ventilator using a different method of ventilation survived.
Oh, the other one that went on the oxygen survived?
A different form. We were using the ventilator, but we were doing what we call
the mechanical one.
They did well. Some are home. And one is still in. So there are two different methods which we use.
Follow-up question?
Do you follow up on person that recover from COVID?
Yeah, I had discussed that earlier. Probably you were probably late on the call or you missed that.
I missed that.
So yes, we do. We do it by telephone call. But also there's a a follow-up period, which will occur after. But the follow-up is variable. It really depends on how the person presented, how ill they were. But there is a general follow-up.
And the two, I think, I'm not sure if it's two or three, that had no trouble history or no contact. What is the update on them?
I'm going to leave that for the best.
Yeah. So, very good question. So, of all the 84 cases that we currently have, 84 COVID-19 cases, the majority of them would have been imported cases. A significant portion would be cases detected through contact tracing of those imported cases or contact tracing of contact. We do have a handful that are being investigated. But at this point, we have, at the very least, a plausible epidemiologic link to explain how those persons would have acquired COVID-19. So we don't have any cases not accounted for. But appreciate that the contact tracing process, and in some cases it can take a few hours, and in some cases it can take many weeks. So we're constantly investigating, and many times we don't make a conclusion until we have absolutely all the facts, until we have exhausted all the possibilities.
Okay. But Dr. Best, you know, from the beginning when they had that, I mean, some of the people that went home to their family and friends, why did they tell them that they have to go into quarantine? Not you all will be have to be going to contact tracing or community spread. Why y'all didn't do that in the beginning? And we will be.
So you're talking about people who would have traveled into Barbados that had to go into quarantine.
Yes, the beaches that came in.
Right.
At the airport, yeah, that came in, and the beaches nationals that came into the airport. Some were tested and some weren't. Some went home to their family without getting quarantined or telling them that they had quarantine. So would y'all let that slip away like that?
So, ma'am, we didn't let anything slip away. We did quarantine persons that were coming into Barbados, and that would have been a home or self-quarantine of persons that came from countries at risk. We had a specific set of countries in mind. The initial set of countries were Italy, Iran, China, and South Korea, because those are the countries that had raging epidemics.
Mm-hmm.
The countries that ended up being the problematic countries turned out to be the U.S. and the U.K. I don't know if you remember a few weeks ago we did a campaign asking persons to contact us at the ministry if they traveled between, I believe it was the 15th of March and the 22nd of March.
Yes, I heard that.
Right. But what had happened was that we realized that was...
Hello?
Caller's dropped out.
He dropped out?
Caller's dropped out.
All right, we'll try to get him back.
While we try to get him back, though, one of the things that I would like us to follow up on is that answer that he gave to the whole question that was raised here by the caller about community spread. The language that he used seemed pretty guarded. So,
but there's Dr. Ford there.
He said that they have a handful of cases, and then he spoke about some plausible epidemiological explanation. That was the term that I recall. But I'd like him to expand on exactly what he's saying there. Because left as it is, you know, people can interpret that to be... sounding as though you're trying to, you're not saying everything that there is. So, is he back? If Dr. Ford is there, right?
Yeah, I can.
Dr. Ford can answer that. Yeah.
I can help answer that.
Yeah.
I make it really, really simple. So when we think about in country spread, you have to be very careful because garbage. Barbados might have different interpretations of what that means. So in most cases, it means that you fit a criteria, which is a defined criteria that was made, which is basically after you did your full investigation, you're having trouble figuring out what the link is. Although in your, from a perspective of investigation, it's like almost like a police investigation. You might believe it is actually this because it's more likely given this scenario.
but you do not have the evidence to say, therefore you have to call it community spread. And then there is another aspect to community spread. So community spread can be not widespread as the scenario that we have now, but you can figure out where the pocket of disease actually is. So it's not a widespread disease within your community, which is kind of definitely not where we are at this particular point. Then when he talks about the epidemiologic standpoint, what he's really getting at is when you actually are investigating, it's like a police investigation. So you're investigating a case as to where the link to this particular aspect is. And you are in the process of an investigation, you've actually finding different links. But I can't come out and tell you, or he can't come up and tell you at this point that this is definitive. Because as you go to each link, what you're going to be doing is testing each link. And trying to find where the point of contact is. So he can't really tell you at this particular point. That's why he said a few cases you're still challenging the link. And as you would understand, those links and challenges right now are clearly negative. Otherwise, there would be called cases. But as you go along in your investigation, you'll eventually figure out where was the point link. In some cases, however, which you have to call your case off, is the person who that person may have contacted might have already cleared the disease. And you might know for sure that it's likely this case because this person was ill 3 weeks ago, for example. And it's likely that the infection could have been from that individual. But at the time of testing, the test is negative. And this is why I think Dr. Cave made it, I think Dr. Best made it, and then the Irish Barbadian has to understand this, is that a negative COVID screen is a negative COVID screen at that point of the disease. It doesn't mean like a week later. And this is why the whole concept of quarantine is important, right? So anytime during the course of that quarantine period, you can develop your disease. And I want to congratulate the nursing who came on and had that discussion. So, but that's another important discussion. So I can test you at this point. It means at that particular interval, you're negative. It doesn't mean that later in the course of 14 days that you may not actually develop disease and go positive. And this is the importance of the quarantine period. So I keep telling people, yes. And I heard the discussion always come up about, you know, test people, test healthcare workers randomly. That's at that particular point that they're negative. But it doesn't mean anything in the longer scope of things. And that's something that's very important to understand. So what he's trying to say from the epidemiologic aspect is you have to go through a testing stage process, like a police investigation. You may be coming up with evidence that here is where it is, but you cannot definitively say that until you do the testing or do further evaluation. So that's really what he's trying to say there.
You use the term a handful, and you use the term a few, which is, what's the specific number?
Sorry, Miss Ellis.
Semantic.
Miss Ellis.
Dr. Bess is trying to speak.
Numbers, you know, we will not be left with anything vague. And everybody will understand because not so long ago, we heard the number two. So when he says a handful, you know, that seems to elevate it beyond two.
Mr. Ellis, he's going to have to give you his numbers.
Mr. Ellis, hey, Anton Best here. I'm sorry, I don't know what happened just now. The number is four.
Four.
Yes. Four.
I have four. We're
okay.
Okay, guys.
Thank you very much, Ms. Undecided. We go to another call. You're on the air. Good afternoon.
Before you move on, this is Clyde Cave. Right. Could I respond to one part of her question, which we didn't address?
Yes, go right ahead, Ms. Dr. Cave.
That was the nine theaters with conceptually, there are nine, give one over to COVID. All those nine, five are connected upstairs, and the other ones are integrated into various services in the hospital, the eye theaters and the obstetric theaters. It's not a simple matter like taking one, cordoning it off, and using that. If it was so, obviously that would have been an easy solution and we would have done that. Any one of those theaters would significantly impact and put at risk all the patients at the Queen Rispa.
Okay. We go to the next
call.
Thank you. You're on the air. Good afternoon. Yes, good afternoon, sir.
Yes, so a pleasant afternoon to you.
Same to you.
Mr. Ellis and the panelists. I have three questions here and a statement, but I noticed that you prefer not to deal with it as an omnibus, but individually. First question to Dr. Ford. Are you totally convinced, Dr. Ford, that the 14-day period is the absolute time frame for incubation. And annex to that is, do you see the possibility of more than one strain in the population?
Did you hear the questions, Dr. Ford?
Yes, I did. Perfect.
Okay, good.
Thank you, sir. That's a brilliant question. I must feel that you're infectious in this position. And I wish I had the full answer to the first question. At this point, from all international evidence, it's suggesting that the 14-day period is appropriate. Like I keep saying, in this disease, nothing is stellar, meaning nothing is fixed, and things can change. But at this point, certainly from all the evidence we have, that we think that is appropriate. The second part of the question was, I can't remember.
Do you have any inkling of imagination that there may be more than one strain in the population?
Oh, yeah. And the only way of knowing that is to do what we call viral culture, which is taking a sample and culture in a lab. But we can't do that in Barbados, and there's nowhere in the Caribbean that will do that. And there's certainly not many areas of the world which will take samples and do those cultures. So I think that might be plausible based on what we're seeing on the ground with some of the patients and how severe some of them present, and then some of them present with mild symptoms. You would have heard more recently from international data that they found a more virulent, meaning a more severe form of this disease in New York and certainly in Lombardy in Italy. And there's nothing to say that none of those strains are in Barbados, because some of our people were pretty ill. And I keep saying all the time, we heard about the ones who died, but we also don't hear about the ones who the intensive care physicians fought with, and those guys fought with, to get to where they actually are home and have more discharge and recovery list so high.
The second question.
Banker, if I may respond to that question as well.
I'm sorry. Yes, hello.
Yes, go ahead, Dr. Bess.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that we have raised the possibility of additional strains, which is what Dr. Ford would have said. So we are partnering with the Pan American Health Organization to do such a study. So we would have the samples archived in our public health lab, and we would send the samples to a PAHO or WHO designated lab as part of this study to determine what strains we actually have that are circulating and match back the specific strains with the signs and the symptoms and the outcomes of the patient. So all of that is in train.
The second one, hold on, Dr. Keith.
Hold a quick second. I just want to follow up what Dr. Bess is saying. What would have provoked the ministry to consider doing this in the first place? Are they seeing something that's provoking them to take this action?
So there are two things that would have happened on our side with Dr. Ford and between the lab. We would have the possibility quite a few weeks ago that we may have different strains, simply because, and I think Dr. Ford would have explained just now, you have patients with different levels of illness. You have patients who are very mild, and you have patients with very aggressive illness, and unfortunately, we have a few persons who have died. So that's on our end. But then on the end, from PAHO's perspective, this is something that they have raised some time back, and they're seeking to answer it, what strains are circulating in this region. So they would have approached us and said, listen, this is something that we are doing. Is the government of Barbados, the Ministry of Health in Barbados, willing to partner with us? And of course, we would have said yes.
All right, thank you. Caller, your last question?
Yeah, I like how you do that, Saka. Dr. Keith, would you say that?
Yes, sir.
Has the pandemic been rallying long enough for you to notice a decline in patients who have been routinely rostered for medical appointments over the last few weeks?
That's a very good question, because it's not just a decline in people attending because they choose not to. We actively close down non-essential services, and we're just in the process of standing back up. So the numbers are certainly down. Part of it because we delayed clinics or canceled clinics, and partly because people have elected not to take the risk of coming into the hospital.
And finally, what suggestions would you, including Nurse Waterman, give to government in respect of reopening our ports, the commercial business, and reopening schools? And when do you hope to commence antibody testing?
Okay. The advice to the governing people who make these very complex and multifaceted decisions, our input has to be with the status of the medical facilities in the country. We have had a pause and the numbers are down. Currently, there's nobody in our most intensive isolation facilities and the number of new cases are down. So at the moment, things are looking pretty good. But one has to be cognizant of the fact that once you stop doing the severe isolation, restriction and lockdown things that we've been doing now, we open up the possibilities of starting the cycle all over again and the disease taking off again. So at the moment, the medical facilities are coping very well. And we have to stand by in case changes cause the numbers to go back up. If we could stay in lockdown forever, we would feel more confident that the numbers would stay down. But that is not a realistic realistic possibility.
Can I ask that from the doctors, from the individual perspective, given the time that we have been battling with COVID, what would you identify as the lessons learned so far? Because each one will perhaps have a different set of lessons. So what have you discerned so far? What is it that Barbados has been able to pick up as far as you can see?
Shall I start?
Yes.
From the services of the hospital, let me just focus on that because there's so very, very many, many lessons. We have realized that we were not in the best possible place ready to respond to sudden, massive, unknown challenges, but then nobody in the world really, really was. But we have demonstrated, I think, that we have been able to rise to the occasion and to put in place many things. We MacGyvered and made do, and I think the evidence is that that seems to have worked initially. The message coming from that, obviously, is we have to rethink the way we do things and be better prepared, because perhaps the new normal is that periodically, hopefully not too often, epidemics like this will occur. The other big message is that the epidemic of COVID was not just about COVID infection. It was about the impact on all the other patients and putting on hold the kind of medical care that patients in Barbados have been accustomed to has caused an increase in the difficulties that those patients have, and we're going to have to cope with the fallout of the pause that we've been on, as well as finding a new way of doing business. It can't go back to medical care as normal. We're going to have to incorporate telemedicine, personal spacing, infection prevention and control, maybe physical redesigns of our plant. I think I'll stop there because there are many other messages.
Yeah, but I want some others too, but the point that has been made there... It was made earlier in this discussion today, and it has to do with those people who have had to be put on hold and trying now to address their concerns with all the confinement that exists right now. How are you going to press ahead with trying to address these urgent matters now?
Yeah, that's occupying a lot of our time at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. There are a couple of initiatives that arguably would have been great to have had before, but we've had to do now, and we'll hope we can keep. One is the pharmacy now being able to home deliver prescriptions to particularly vulnerable populations. The other thing is that instead of the many people coming to an outpatient clinic, some of the contact will be by telephone or video, so that maybe the numbers of actual physical visits to the hospital can be decreased while the amount of medical supervision remains the same. And the other thing is a new program that we're working of maybe having community health workers to go into the community to target our outpatient population that needs to be followed. This is distinct from the polyclinics where they act to prevent the diseases getting worse, so they have to be referred to the hospital. This will be a specialty service to look at if we can support our outpatients in the community in a better way so they don't have to physically access the hospital. I'm sure there'll be other initiatives, but these are three things that we learned from COVID, and I think they're going to be very important going forward as we practice the new medicine.
Tell us about the impact of it on autopsies, because I have heard people talk about having to wait really long now.
Yes, the autopsy service has been basically suspended, again, because of the risk of spreading a virus when there are so very many things that are unknown. That's something that has been worked on in conjunction with the undertakers and the mortuary service, and hopefully we will now come up with a way of moving things forward. But with deaths at this time, there were legal implications, there were infection transmission implications, and there were also all the social implications of not having large gatherings for funeral services.
Thanks. Who else will give us their experience? That's Dr. Cave, who just spoke.
Yes.
Dr. Ford, what is your take on the lessons learned?
Lessons learned. Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Dr. Ford.
Hi, great. There's so many. I think I honed in on two of them, and one was a bit different. So one is about figuring out what to do in scenarios which are not ideal. And I mentioned that very early in my call. That for us in the infectious disease world, infection prevention control was a challenge, is doing things out of the norm, but making it work so that, you know, every Barbadian is protected. But I think the other thing I wish I really honed on, and I always tell the speak about the administrative level, is something I probably never experienced from my since I've been back in Barbados 2013, 2012. From Canada, and it is a level of team spirit among the isolation services, which I don't even get in the QEH. So I'll give you an example. So we had situations where we had to get school up, or even Harrison's Point up, and we had a situation where we had doctors been taking care of patients as they do now. They mop the floor, nurses help mop the floor, they help clean the walls. They help give patients food, or these help make the bed. These are things that are classically or commonly not seen in the hospital. And I think it's the spirit of working as a family and trying to get patients better. And I think the patients have seen that and actually have commented on that. So that sort of team effort and team spirit is something that also helps encourage staff in a difficult time working with a disease, for example, that you know, that you can be affected by, and it can cause a mortality in yourself or morbidity or even affect your family. So I think, to my mind, if I was going to call it, one thing that I've learned from this is the importance of not being a doctor in the situation, but being a part of the process, whether, you know, you're like an orderly or like a maid or whatever other services, auxiliary services being offered, working like that. And we took that down. We had orderlies leading shifts. We had housekeepers leading shifts. I think that whole idea worked very well in the setting, giving everybody the power to function at their level, and recognizing that without the orderly function, or without the nurse functioning, or without the housekeeping functioning, that there will be problems that we all will be challenging country. So I just thought of that from my mind. Still rings as one of the key things that I've figured out in this outbreak.
Those are the pros. When you look at the weaknesses, what do you think we need to put in place for the long term?
Right. So for the long term, I think it's this. I think we need to look back in Barbados and assess how this is hitting us and all across the globe. And I'm glad you asked that point, because I think we need to recognize that today it is COVID 19, and tomorrow it might be some other disease that we don't even have in our mindset, but that we should always be prepared in that aspect, and ensuring that these facilities which are built and are put in place are used for the purposes for which they are built, and that people are recurrently
are repetitively trained. I think one of the weaknesses, and David L. Steppel said, even Barbados, I think one of the weaknesses in the Caribbean, is that we often wait for things to happen. As just as we have a hurricane hitting the Caribbean, it's almost hurricane season. That's going to be a challenge in itself. But with hurricane season, one of the major things for me is that we have to have a regional response team trained that can descend on the ground to help countries in the region deal with these aspects. Because if one country gets in trouble, I'm telling you, all of us are going to be in trouble pretty quickly, as we've recognized from this outbreak. So one of the failures, I think, in the region, and Barbados is one, that we need to focus a little bit more on rapid response scenarios and training for highly infectious diseases. And as a regional group, certainly it's something that CARICOM needs to take up. There's no way that they can't take it up now. This is something that I've preached now since 2015. And I think we're at that particular stage at this point. So that for me is a weakness. Because we can't respond the way we want to respond because we don't have those parameters in place.
Dr. Beth?
Yeah. All right, before Dr. Best comes in, we need to take a commercial break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Brass Tacks, the Sanka Price, with you along with John Stout. And Dr. Anton Best, you were about to tell us about some of the lessons learned.
Yeah, so from my perspective, the main lesson learned is the importance of good communication as a key component of good governance and strategic management. And by that, I mean, how do you target the fears that people have? And these are fears of the general public, fears of persons who are healthcare workers and other persons as well. And how do you constantly engage people to get the best possible outcomes? So the key thing that I've learned is the importance of communication to staff at all levels, the importance of communication to policymakers as well as to the general public. And even though we would have done a lot of the groundwork in terms of engaging the Nursing Association, for instance, the Barbados Association of Medical Practitioners, the social partnerships, civil society, general public, it's important to constantly engage all partners in a constant dialogue. And a lot of the times it's very easy to forget or to lose sight of the importance of that continuous engagement. And sometimes that leads to problems. It leads to misunderstandings. You know, when you're too quiet, when you're not saying things as often as you probably ought to. So that would be my contribution, the importance of good communication in a crisis such as this.
David, you want a follow-up question?
No, I think you can wrap up.
Okay, thanks. Ms. Waterman, I know you're still there, and I know you want to give well wishes to the nurses.
Yes, apart from that, I wanted to just say also with respect to lessons learned, I'll be echoing some of the sentiments, but really the importance of standing together in a national crisis was really borne out. And as Dr. Best said, within the context of that, then the importance of laying the fears and providing the relevant information to the public. But the way that the public responded with gratitude to the frontline nurses, particularly our nurses, was really humbling for us. And learning just how fragile we are as a society in this pandemic was real. With respect to the long-term needs, we really need to look at the national emergency plans, simulated plans for way beyond hurricanes. As I said, I think that was said before, and moving into areas such as these pandemics. Now, I had a question for the doctors, actually, but I know you're rounding up, that my concern really provoked by a question that was raised by a member of public is with respect to vaccines. Now, his question was about opening up the community again when it's fully fledged, what's happening. And that has to be done, of course, cautiously, carefully with respect to the science. But a major part of it is going to be the capacity for vaccinate. And we know that vaccinations, the science is not showing that that is on board yet, maybe next year or whatever. And also a major concern coming out of the scientific world, China, et cetera, is that there's no solid information being seen that persons are developing antibodies against the coronavirus. And it's been seen in that way because there are a number of persons who were infected first and were reinfected and a resurge of infection. So hence, what will be the policy and what is the approach going to be with respect to vaccinations when we reopen the community? And so let me just have my last say in terms of the message for International Nurses Day to all our nurses. in this momentous year 2020 and the National Nurses Week is one of empowerment, really, to harness the power that you have as the beating heart of your healthcare service, charged with maintaining the health of the nation and achieving the National Sustainable Development Goals. And our resounding voices of the entire fraternity must be heard in this message. There is no going back to the pre-COVID-19 deficient working conditions. We demand better for our nurses and patients and command respect as a profession. We fully appreciate the educational information of our doctors. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Waterman. And doctors, I'd like to just ask this one on the WhatsApp. I'm interested in finding out the type of material that should be used to make masks. Every seamstress is making these masks, and I haven't heard what type of material that the virus will not penetrate. Please ask your doctors present what is the best material to use for these masks. Any takers? Dr. Best, Dr. Ford?
Sure. So what I would like to say from my perspective is that there's no one material that is sufficient. What we have been recommending people to use is cotton. It's just regular cotton. You would have different manufacturers and different people making recommendations as to the different types of materials, how many layers, et cetera. But there's no scientific evidence to suggest that any one material is better than the other. Remember, and I think Dr. Ford would have touched on it sometime earlier, remember what it is that you're trying to do is you're trying to limit the spread of germs that the wearer may have. So essentially, the same way how you recommend people to use a tissue as part of good respiratory hygiene when they're sneezing and when they're coughing or cough or sneeze into your elbow, the fabric face covering is doing essentially the same thing. So you're just limiting the spread. So a number of different fabric materials can accomplish that.
Okay, thank you. And we can get one last question in, Don? Okay, just put one last person in. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi, I just have a quick comment. I'm very interested in hearing Dr. Ford's last comment about the region not being reactive and being more proactive. And I think from listening to Dr. Warren's point of view, I think we can all agree that COVID isn't disappearing anytime soon. This isn't a three-month problem. At the global level, certainly they're seeing second waves as they open the resurgence. It affects us at the domestic level because once the airlines start to fly, they're going to resume travel and people are going to come here from these UK, US, et cetera. So a lot of what Dr. Ford explained was based on the idea that there are low levels, Dr. Ford and Dr. Cave, low levels of disease now, and so therefore the average patient who comes into the QH needing appendicitis or laparotomy won't have COVID. But that seems very short-term in my mind. If we're recognizing that this problem isn't going away in 2 months or 3 months or 4 months, why would we invest money that we're saying we don't have in outfitting a substandard place when it is likely that in the long run, we are going to eventually have the asymptomatic patient with COVID who will then come in and be operated on in the hospital with appendicitis or laparotomy, and then all the work that we've done over the time is for naught. And so therefore, that's my question to them. And even look at the Harrison Point area. We did that when we didn't have a high level of contagion. So isn't Dr. Warren simply asking for the administrators to do the same thing with regards to the operating theaters? Have that kind of foresight in recognizing that eventually we're going to have community disease, whether it's we contain the first wave or it comes in the second wave, we're going to have this community disease, and we have to prepare for those asymptomatic patients who are going to come into the QEH for emergency surgeries.
Dr. Bess or Dr. Ford, you have 90 seconds to answer. Dr. Bess or Dr. Ford? Hello, Dr. Bess or Dr. Ford? Are they still there?
Hello?
I'm still here.
Dr. Ford is responding. Yes, okay. Just could you answer, because we have to wrap up. It's about two minutes.
Yes, so it's a process. So it really depends on what's going on. So risk stratification at this point.
This is the recommendation. Like we said before, that recommendation may change and measures will be put in place where that is concerned. I think we have addressed that quite extensively in the conversation. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for participating in today's program. I thought it was an extremely intense program. Even that during the break at lunchtime, and I went to get some sunshine, and people were talking about it in the lobby because of they were hearing information coming out about the QEH and about the systems that have been put in place to take care of Barbados.